This programme was previously broadcast live on Love Sport Radio, so some items may be out of date. For more podcasts or to listen live, visit lovesportradio.com.
Yes, good evening. This is Love Sport, and this is the Love Sport Review with me, Matt Beadle, with you until 10 o'clock this evening. Plenty coming up in the next 3 hours. We're going to be casting our eye over all the sporting action of the past 7 days. Plenty to discuss, so much to discuss, from boxing to swimming to Zlatan, and of course to the Open, Shane Lowry winning his first major just a few moments ago at Portrush. Wonderful, wonderful moment for him, and a great atmosphere there too. At 8 o'clock, of course, we've got the AFC Wimbledon podcast coming up. We'll be talking to the guys about current friendlies against Bournemouth and Plymouth Argyle. And at 9 p.m, we'll be moving on to some transfer rumours with the Rumour Mill show. I'll be joined by Graham Butler for that at 9 p.m, just casting our eye over some of the big transfer talking points this week that haven't happened yet. Gareth Bale, obviously a big one there, and Romelu Lukaku another. But the Open first, obviously the 148th Open has its winner, and it's the first ever winner, Ireland's very own Shane Lowry earning his first major quite comfortably ahead of the chasing pack in the end. Conditions at Royal Portrush were pretty horrendous, we have to say. Rain crashing down from around 3 p.m, naturally making it very difficult for everyone involved. Perhaps not so much for Lowry, to be fair, who knows the conditions, he's used to them, and it showed as he effectively cruised to that notorious claret jug. And Graham McDowell as well said about Portrush, because this is one of the big things, I think, of the tournament, that after an absence of about 70 years in rotation at the Open, it returned with a vengeance. And Graham McDowell earlier said it was overwhelmingly full of good cheer. Many of those in attendance called it out as being one of the best links courses they've ever seen, one of the best majors they've ever been to. And I think that positive emotion and feeling towards the championship really showed there was never a loser. Well, there never is a loser amongst the crowd in golf, is there really? I mean, the fans are rooting for one more so than the other, but no one's ever willing the other to lose. It's just a partisan, friendly atmosphere. And of course, there were some losers, notably Rory McIlroy. Had roller coaster a couple of days in his own backyard, 5 years on, nearly to the day from winning the Open in Liverpool in 2014, but didn't quite do it this time around. It's such a shame he didn't make the cut, and actually quite difficult to watch his interview afterwards, and that's now been beamed all around the world as he held back tears talking to Tim Burton from Sky Sports, who to be fair was also very close to tears. A tough moment to endure and even more difficult to watch. But I think the key thing from all of that is the fact that he said, "I didn't play my part, but everyone in Northern Ireland played theirs," which I think is a lovely time to switch over to Matt Cooper, who is now on the line, golf writer. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. It's very excited here in Portrush. Shane Lowry's just walked into the media centre.
Oh, lovely.
Talking to the media. Yeah, and you got it dead right. It's very wet, very damp here, but emotions are quite high, and everyone is looking, especially in the media centre, we're looking to get our work polished off, because there's going to be one hell of a party in Portrush tonight.
Well, are some of the guys still there? So Rory McIlroy, is he still around? Pedro Harrington?
Oh, I don't know about them. I guess they're all at home, but the fans are just heading straight to Portrush, and the media will be doing so. I find it very difficult not to believe that Shane Lowry won't make an appearance at a pub tonight. I was chatting to an Irish journalist early this morning, actually, from Dublin, and he said it's possible that Shane Lowry might be the most popular Irish sportsman of them all, which seemed a little bit far-fetched when he first said it. But then he went on to say that the reason why the Irish people love him is that he's very successful, but he's exactly the sort of guy who, when the Gaelic football final's on, you'll find Shane Lowry down the pub with his mates, and he'll interact with the public. So this is going to be a huge week back in Ireland. Tonight is going to be brilliant, but like next week, I expect quite a few funny scenes in the next week from all around Ireland.
Look out for all the Twitter videos coming out. Plenty of Guinness are pouring, I would imagine.
Yep.
So just talk me through today. How was it? I mean, listen, sometimes at the Open, you want to see the drama. We all talk about Van der Velde back in the day, but today it wasn't really to be. I mean, it was quite comfortable in the end, wasn't it?
It was, but I mean, it's always very difficult, isn't it? Like, we're in the bubble here, and it wouldn't surprise me for people at home who thought it didn't have massive excitement. But I can guarantee here it was fantastic, because everyone was on edge. They didn't want Shane Lowry to blow it and have a nightmare. I'd actually say that the last 3 days have had three of the best marches up the 18th I've ever seen at the Open, and I've been attending it since 1994 as a fan or a journalist. And so we had Friday night when Rory McIlroy came up here, and I know a lot of people have been painting it as a bit of a bad day for Rory. In the end, I think Rory had a pretty spectacular week, which seems really contrary, but unless he had won, he could not have had a more remarkable World Cup 18. He really reconnected with the Northern Irish people on Friday, and that was quite emotional. Yesterday was just insane. Shane Lowry shot 63, and it was bizarre. I mean, like, I went out to the 18th late last night, and it was as if he'd won the Open itself. There were ole, ole, ole all around the 18th. It was actually louder and more fun last night than it was when he won. And when he won was pretty good, sort of like an hour ago. So that's three fantastic sort of conclusions that they've managed to stage manage here. And given how much the people of Portrush have been desperate for this for a long, long time, they never thought it would come. They got the call sort of 5 years ago that they could finally get a major again. And they've a lot of hard work's gone into this. I've spoken to a lot of people around Portrush, have been coming here a couple of times this year. It has been huge, huge production. I'm so pleased for them that they've got an Irish winner.
Yeah, absolutely. It's lovely. And just to quickly touch on McIlroy, again, that interview, obviously very, very difficult to watch, really holding back the tears. And I'd like to get your view on the fact that there were a few whispers, because the nature of PGA Tour life, of course, he's going now to Memphis to play in the FedEx Invitational. There is no cut there. I think it's a £10 million prize fund. Some people say, do you know what, maybe he's not that bothered because he can now go to another competition straight after and maybe win that one, or maybe earn a few pounds that way. You can clearly see that for McIlroy, this was such a big deal, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't think it's... I wouldn't say it's a case that he doesn't care or anything. I think it would be naive to say that he is not somebody who is as driven as Tiger Woods. Mm-hmm. Tiger Woods, at his height, was somebody for whom victory was the be-all and end-all. And I don't think it's the case with Rory McIlroy. But it's interesting. If you're of the opinion that your sports people must only be victory machines, then you would have to say that Rory McIlroy doesn't cut the mustard. But in actual fact, the reason why he is not a victory machine is that actually he kind of wants a life off the golf course that isn't a little bit, what would be the word? Not what the word would be, like mental. Mm-hmm. People like Nick Faldo and Tiger Woods, their life off the course was marred by the fact that they were so desperate to be so perfect on the golf course. And I am led to believe that Rory McIlroy is well aware of the sacrifices they made off the course, and he's not willing to make those. And if that means that he doesn't win as much as he would otherwise, then that's a sacrifice he's willing to make. Now, that makes him quite frustrating to watch. But then what you also saw on Friday is that Rory McIlroy, he's such a peculiar paradox. He makes the simple look impossible, and he makes the impossible look really simple. And when he's on fire, he's brilliant. But when he's not on fire, he can do some pretty clumsy things. I hope that he finds another spell where he starts winning majors again. It's pretty tricky that he's gone 5 years without one. But I find it very difficult to believe that he's not going to win another major. And strangely, for this tournament, it's a tournament that favours people who are in their 30s. So ironically, he's now in his next 10 years is the perfect time for him to start winning majors. And also, this tournament's going to come back to Portrush, and the experience he had this week will probably actually favour him there, because he won't have been quite so het up and quite so nervous as I think is transparently the case that he was on Thursday.
Lovely stuff, Matt. Just before you go, Brooks Koepka, Mr. Consistency yet again. It seems to be the case that whenever you're talking to your mates and you're suggesting who you should place on before a tournament when you want to get down the bookies, Koepka's always the name that comes up. Is this guy just going to turn into be one of the best we've seen, do you think?
He's quite an enigma. he's said in the last few weeks that he doesn't really practice for normal events. He's not really bothered about normal events. The only things that really bother him are majors. Now, that's quite interesting, because it's now 9 months until the next major. We're going to have to wait until the start of April next year. Now, if we had to take Brooks Koepka at his word, what's he going to do in the next 9 months? Is he really just going to drift through the next 9 months? So that actually starts to ask questions of his own drive, and he's going to have to sort of face those questions. And it's also strange that if he keeps boasting that he wants to win majors more than ordinary events, what's he going to do next time he's in contention in an ordinary event? Is he going to fluff it on purpose so he can keep building this reputation as being a major champion? And the flip side of that is that he is very, very good at majors. To be honest, he played pretty poorly this week, putted especially badly. I actually saw him as he was walking away from the scorer's hut tonight. I didn't look best pleased with himself. And yet, what's he done? He's got a top five. He's finished top five every major championship this year. And he's done this one not playing very well. I think so. It doesn't totally surprise me. I didn't think he'd win this week for sure. I thought he doesn't play very well in the wins particularly. But I think he will continue to be a threat in the big majors. And the fact that he is so confident in playing majors, because there's one simple thing that he does very well that people like Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods at their height did, which is he recognises other people panic a lot. So he sort of sits back and lets them panic. So that's going to put him in a good position going forward.
Where does this attitude place him amongst his peers? Because if you are quite brash, and you could say on one hand, it's a focus. It's a pure driven focus on the sport and the fact that he wants to win, much like Tiger Woods. But where does this place him amongst his peers? Is he friends with the others? Do you ever hear anything about other golfers not particularly taking to Koepka?
Not so much. I mean, he's rumoured to be strong friends with Dustin Johnson, although sometimes there were famous rumours at the Ryder Cup that they had a bit of a ding-dong afterwards. It wouldn't surprise me if he slightly winds other golfers up with some of his talk, because he does kind of trash talk the others, not specifically, but simply in the fact that he says he knows how to play majors and they don't. And he did, to some degree, try to trash talk Shane Lowry last night, when saying that Lowry had famously fluffed a four-shot lead in the US Open a couple of years ago, when other players chose not to address that subject. But as far as I'm aware, I tell you what is very apparent. I don't know about the players, but we were discussing this the other night. I'm staying in a house this week with four of the journalists, and we're very aware that the sport of golf kind of judges Koepka almost as that he keeps having this success almost in a sort of, it's bizarre, almost like in an unfair way. And it's because he does it in quite a unconventional way. This business of sort of, he gets quite angry sort of saying things like, I'm flying under the radar, nobody's taking me seriously. When in actual fact, he's making that up a little bit. He gets plenty of coverage. But he's sort of doing it to put fire in his own belly. He's sort of doing the sort of thing that Alex Ferguson and Arsene Wenger used to do to drive their teams to success. And it's contrived, but it's quite a clever policy to sort of make himself irked so that he can improve his performance.
Absolutely. Matt, thank you very much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
That's great. See you.
That was Matt Cooper, golf writer, of course, referring to Shane Lowry and the winner of a first ever major, the 148th Open, Shane Lowry winning today at Royal Portrush. Wonderful stuff. Now we're going to move quickly on to the Tour de France, because Briton Simon Yates claimed his second stage win today at stage 15. Geraint Thomas as well gaining some ground on leader Julien Alaphilippe. Delighted to say that we've got Guy Andrews, writer and editor of Magnum Cycling, on the line. Hello, Guy.
Hello there, Matt. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you? An enthralling stage 15 today.
Wonderful stage today. I mean, it's been a wonderful Tour de France so far, and today was, it was a fantastic day again.
I mean, as things stand, we're looking at one of the most pulsating final weeks, right, in years at the Tour de France.
Absolutely. Probably it's. I mean, many of the sports journalists have been saying that it's possibly the most exciting Tour de France in 30 years. It's so rare that we go into the third week with, I mean, we've got sort of six riders all about 39 seconds between one another, all with a chance of winning it, all kind of on top of their game. I mean, Julien Alaphilippe is doing an amazing job to stay in yellow, but obviously the chasing pack behind, they're so close. It's anyone's game, really. I mean, it really is. And it's so rare in recent years that the Tour de France has been like that.
Intrigued by the Yates brothers, I'd love to know a little bit more. We often talk about the Brownie brothers in triathlon, massive British athletes. What can you tell us about the Yates brothers?
Well, they're quite unique actually in British cycling, because they're two guys from Preston. You know, they both had a pretty meteoric rise through cycling. I think they've gone a slightly alternative route to a lot of the other British riders of their generation, in that they've kind of they've found their own place with Scott Mitchelton, and you know, I think they're doing it. You know, they're not doing it in the sort of, let's say, the traditional way that has been of the last sort of 10 years, where we've had riders come through Team Sky. So I think they've taken their own route, and certainly they're showing that, you know, I mean, I think this tour has been problematic for both of them. But I think, you know, they're showing in races that they've got the potential to win. I think they've been left to kind of develop their own way of racing, which I think is really important for two such talented guys, really. And I don't know, I think obviously this year isn't for them, but I think, I mean, obviously Simon winning today was fantastic. And I think they've got, you know, some good years ahead of them. So it's certainly early days from the point of view of maybe winning the tour. And I think, you know, they've both got potential to do that. But yeah, as I say, this year it's not going to be for them. I mean, there's so much talent in the tour this year, and the race. I mean, the race today. I mean, all the guys at the finish were all complaining about how fast it was, and you know, they're not even into the Alps yet. So you know, it's shaping up to be a tough race.
Geraint Thomas, obviously last year's winner, he gained 27 seconds on Alaphilippe today. What do you think his chances are?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think Geraint's had a really hard run up to the tour. He had a bad crash, and I think that set him back. And then he had a crash early on in the Tour de France. So I think that's kind of, that always does seem to sort of have a knock on effect for the riders. I mean, bearing in mind that, you know, recovering from the efforts of a stage is hard enough, but recovering from a crash too is tough. Even if he didn't actually do himself much damage, you still put your body through an awful lot. So I think he's showing his form. And I think today was obviously a lot stronger. I think I'll give him some confidence. But there's some other guys that are also, you know, they're at the top of their game right now. So I think it's put Team Ineos on the back foot, very much so. I think Alaphilippe winning the time trial was really unexpected, so I think that probably rocked them quite considerably. But Geraint's a tough guy, you know, he'll hang in there, there's no doubt. So I think he's got every chance, but I think they'll all know now it can be any one of six of them to win this. You know, it really could. It's that close.
Okay, any one of six, Guy, I'm going to put you on the spot. Who is your money on? Got to do it.
It's really hard. I'd love to see, I hate to say this, obviously, as a British sports journalist, but I would love to see a French rider win this year, because I think it's so important for the race. I mean, you've seen the crowds on the Col de Tourmalet yesterday. I mean, you know, for me as a sort of an old school cycling fan, I'd love to see a French rider win. It's been more than 30 years since they won the Tour de France. You know, it's their race. It's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like a Frenchman winning, I don't know, winning the World Snooker Championships or something for years on end, and a British player never getting a look in. It's kind of a bit like that. So I'd love to see one of the French guys win. I'd love to see Alaphilippe win. I don't think he will. I'd love to see him win, because I just think he's actually ignited the race. I mean, he's been so fantastic. But then, on the other hand, I think my head would say it's going to be Thomas. It may be Pinot. If it's going to be Thibaut Pinot, he's showing some really good form. So put me on the spot. I don't know. I guess my head says Pinot or Thomas, and my heart says Alaphilippe. So there we go. How's that?
Wonderful. Guy, thank you very much for your time.
And thank you, Matt.
Cheers.
Yeah, great stuff.
That was Guy Andrews, writer and editor of Magnum Cycling, controversially saying that he wants a Frenchman to win the Tour de France. Right, plenty of boxing coming up after this.
For the fans, by the fans. Love Sport Radio.
Yep, good evening. This is Love Sport with me, Matt Beadle, with you until 10 o'clock this evening. Now, we're going to get onto some boxing in a moment, but I just want to touch on Adam Peaty before we do that. Now, obviously, a hugely successful British swimmer, and has been at the World Champs in South Korea today, where he became the first man to swim the 100-metre breaststroke in under 57 seconds. Sorry. Now, that's breaking his own record. His own record he beat with a time of 56.88 seconds. Now, this was in a semi-final, not the final, the semi-final of the World Champs in South Korea today. Now, to put this into context, he's the only man to swim that distance in sub 58 seconds. So that just gives you an idea of how good and how dedicated this guy is. He's still just 24. He's an Olympic champion, a world champion, a Commonwealth champion, a European champion, obviously a world record holder, and he's achieved everything that he could possibly achieve in the sport. But a sign, I guess, of true greatness is from those who continue to thrive, who continue to better themselves. And after he won all those medals at Rio, he and his team sat back and they embarked upon Project 56. They gave themselves that goal to try and swim the 100-metre breaststroke in under 57 seconds. Today, he has managed to do that. And immediately afterwards, he came out of the pool. He said, "Now I have to go one better." He says, "I'm the finest athlete I've ever been and hopefully the finest person I've ever been." He's admitted recently that he has struggled with the mentality of being on top, of having to go better time after time after time. But he continues to do it. And a wonderful achievement from Adam Peaty today. Fantastic stuff. Talking of fantastic stuff, there was a great night of boxing at the O2 last night. Dillian White claiming a victory over Colombia's Oscar Rivas. Big wins as well for David Price and Derek Chisora. We've got Chris Williamson on the line. Sorry, Chris, of Boxing Monthly. How are you doing?
I'm good, Matt. How are you?
Good, thank you. Just about got your name right there. Right, a big, big night of boxing last night. Thoroughly enjoyed the show. I have to say, it was obviously pay-per-view, the fight, but it wasn't a packed O2, was it?
It wasn't full. I mean, part of the reason for that will be that there was a big show by the rival promoter, Frank Warren, the week before. You wouldn't usually get two big sort of heavyweight bills on consecutive Saturdays. So Warren had his big heavyweight hope, Daniel Dubois, who had a good win there last week. So that's going to be part of the reason. I guess it's the holiday season as well. And also, Hearn has just announced that there's a big show here. He announced it officially yesterday, but it was well known in boxing circles that the best lightweight in the world, Vasyl Lomachenko, the Ukrainian, absolutely amazing fighter, probably the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world at any weight, will be fighting Luke Campbell next month at the O2 as well. So there's lots for fans to kind of pick and choose from. So that will be probably one of the reasons why it wasn't completely packed out. Albeit it was a pretty good crowd. I'd say there's probably about, I was there last night. It was probably about 12,000 or 13,000 there, I think.
Still a decent atmosphere, wasn't it? And you mentioned the Frank Warren card last week. Joe Joyce obviously was in that. Now, a few months back, we saw a bit of back and forth between Joe Joyce and Derek Chisora, and Chisora claimed he was going to fight him, and then he decided he wasn't going to fight him, and he had a bit of beef with David Haye, and now David Haye is working with Derek Chisora. Funny the way boxing goes. But last night, a brutal KO of Artur Spilka. Very, very impressive from Chisora, wasn't it?
It was. It was really. It was quite worrying for a little while actually, and the referee, Mark Lyson, came under a bit of stick for that.
It
was a little bit late, but I've watched it again, and that first right hook from Chisora, which is an absolute beauty, kind of stunned Spilka, but he had his, I guess it was a reflex action. He still had his gloves up around his head, which it looked as if he was defending himself, albeit he was on his way down, probably. So it probably was a little bit late, but tremendous knockout for Chisora. That's a really good result for him, and he gets a tremendous reception.
It's incredible isn't it? The way that it's come out. I mean, they've adopted the Anthony Joshua chant for him, that White Stripes track. It's now old Derek Chisora. I mean, people are massive fans, and he's 35 now, right? He said, "I still feel like I'm 16. Alexander Usyk was in the crowd. Interestingly, we mentioned Joe Joyce. They're obviously looking at Joseph Parker as well. Who do you think Chisora is going to get to next? And do you really believe, at the age that he is and the rounds that he's gone through, that he's still got a chance of being a world champion?
I don't think Chisora will be a world champion now. But he's, as you alluded to there, he absolutely loves the game. You can't really see him quitting. He's quite a successful man outside the ring, actually. He doesn't really need to fight for financial reasons. He just loves it. He seems to have calmed down to an extent. It's all relative in heavyweight boxing, of course. And he just seems to be really enjoying this. this phase of his career. A great win last night. It sounds as if the Joseph Parker fight is the next one, which will possibly be on the next white bill, which I'm sure we'll touch on shortly. But that's another cracking fight against obviously the former WBO champ Parker, who white beat in the same O2 arena. But real Indian summer for Derek Chisora, and he you can tell he's absolutely loving every moment of it. You know, that entrance with Hotel California and the crowd just go crazy for him.
Well, before we get to Dillian White, just going to touch on David Price and Dave Allen. Now, it was an intriguing scrap for me. At one point, I kind of described it as captivatingly dull because it was a technical masterclass, I suppose, from Price. I felt like Dave Allen didn't really put him under the pressure that he could have done, because a lot of the talking points of David Price over the past few years has been his stamina. I mean, I know Tony Bellew said after the fight that he's actually one of the fittest heavyweights. He knows it's all in the mind. It's all about the nerves and the mentality with David Price. But a really big performance and a big moment for David Price now. 36, what's he going to do?
Yeah, you're right. It's all about that nervous energy that he seems to burn, doesn't he? You know, which is kind of odd given that amateur pedigree that he has. Mm. Bizarre really that he was the underdog going into a fight with David Allen, who had nowhere near the amateur pedigree that Price had. It was a masterclass. I gave David Price every single round last night. And it was one of those where going in, people were like, this is going to go three or four rounds, you know, and a little bit like, I don't know if you recall, Tommy Morrison fought George Foreman many, many
Absolutely,
years ago. And
yeah.
People were like, you know, this is not going to last more than a few rounds, but that went the full 12 rounds. And this, you know, this obviously went into the later rounds before the retirement in Allen's corner. It just really showed that boxing is about levels, and Price was just far too good for Allen. They, as you say, it was kind of a dull fight, but given that, you know, it's almost impossible for a David Price fight to be dull, given that you know he could fall apart at any moment. He could, you know, he's got that tremendous power that he still doesn't fully believe in because of the setbacks that he's had along the way. So it was, you know, it was an intriguing dull fight, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
No, absolutely. And you mentioned levels there. Dillian White said that after his fight with Rivas. I'm not sure that it was all about levels with White. I think that you are seeing now fight after fight, especially after the defeat to Joshua, where he was knocked out by a right-hand uppercut. Same thing happened yesterday. Obviously not knocked out, but knocked down by Rivas with the uppercut. But that was pretty much Rivas's final hurrah, I think, in that fight. He didn't have much left in the tank. And White really is boxing well now, isn't he?
He is. I mean, I agreed. I actually had it closer than what I understood. I haven't watched it back on the television yet, but I believe the commentary team had it pretty clear for White. I had it 1-1-4, 1-1-3. So only by a round, given that 10-8 round that Oscar would have scored in that ninth round, where, as you say, he knocked White down. But his boxing has come on leaps and bounds under Mark Tibbs. He's boxing very, very well, and you've got to admire someone who's fighting at that consistently at that level. He's almost at the point where when Joshua a few years ago, he was constantly, you know, at the O2 and sort of made that his venue, if you like. It feels a little bit as though White's done the same now, and he's fighting top level fighter after top level fighter, and you know he's in that straight he's kind of almost playing roulette, isn't he? Because he's now, he's been number one. It's been well publicised at WBC for some time. He's now got that interim belt, and he's essentially for sure the next mandatory challenger.
He
finds himself as like a pay-per-view fighter now. So he can't have a gimme fight. So what does he do now? Does he wait for his title fight? It sounds as if they're going to have one more towards the end of the year. But it's a risky game when you've got that pot of gold at the end of this, you know?
Very, very strange scenario for Dillian White. Like you said, about 600 plus days as the number one contender for the WBC. He now has to fight Deontay Wilder, but he's in this strange situation where it looks like Wilder's going to fight Tyson Fury potentially in February. He doesn't want to wait that long for that fight. You could say maybe he should have taken that $5 million pot and fought Anthony Joshua, especially after seeing what happened against Ruiz Jr. He wants the fight, so it looks like he's going to be back before Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. It looks as if it's going to be another big O2 night before Christmas, where he really has that one last game of Russian roulette before he has that WBC challenge. I think Eddie Hearn has made his view quite clear that, you know, the WBC title fight will be even bigger once Deontay Wilder has fought Tyson Fury in that rematch, which is likely for around February, March. So it looks like it's on either way for next summer, as long as White wins this warm up. But again, it's difficult to see how he can have a warm up, if you like, if he wants to keep this Sky box office status. You know, there's been some tough fights on pay per view, but I don't think Sky are in the mood to kind of sanction just a gimme fight as pay per view. So it will be interesting to see who he does fight.
Wonderful. Thanks for that, Chris.
Thanks, Matt.
That was Chris Williamson of Boxing Monthly. Right, coming up, I'm excited for this. We've got Matt Ketchell talking all things Newcastle.
From Ali to Zaha, we've got it covered. Love Sport Radio.
This is the Love Sport Review Show. Me, Matt Beadle, with you through to 10 o'clock this evening. Now, I sense a rant coming on, because on the line, we've got Matt Ketchell, football writer for Match of the Day magazine and an avid Newcastle fan. Matt, how are you doing?
Yes, I'm buzzing, mate. We've just beat West Ham 1-0 in the Premier League Asia Trophy, so things are looking up.
There you go, your title winners. Boss, did you win the trophy?
No. Wolves took that. They beat us 4-0 through the week, so they're deserved winners of that. But, you know, a 1-0 win, that could be our only win of the season.
Every cloud, there you go. Now, listen, I want to talk to you about Steve Bruce, because we've had numerous Newcastle fans and journalists on this show, and it is depressing every time they're on, because they sound down in the dumps. They're so angry about the fact that Steve Bruce is the manager. They're annoyed at Mike Ashley, obviously. There's no players coming in. There's players going out. What's your take on it?
Well, it's a self-made mess, isn't it? Another self-made mess. We had Rafa Benitez as our manager, you know, probably one of the top 15 managers in the world. He was there. All he wanted was a bit of financial backing. He doesn't want to get us into Europe. He wants to be top of the non-Europe pile, if you want. He wants us to compete with the other 13 clubs who are not expected to challenge for Europe. That's all he wanted. He wanted some basic improvements to the training ground to be made. I think he was looking for an excuse, Rafa, to stay as our manager. And Ashley inexplicably has, pinched Steve Bruce from Sheffield. It's probably going to cost us about what it would have cost to pay Rafa for the year to continue the progress that he's made. So it's absolutely baffling. Steve Bruce, can anyone justify his appointment? He's the Brexit boss. He's massively unpopular, and he's going to cost us a fortune once the dust settles.
So is there any affection from any part of Newcastle here that looks at Steve Bruce and thinks, this guy's homegrown, it's his club, he's going to give everything to the club to be manager, to try and make them successful? Is anybody thinking that? I mean, there's this I'm from Wall's End, he's from Wall's End meme that's been going around. Is anybody going to grow on Steve Bruce?
Well, I've been supporting the club for about 30 years now, and I'm a football journalist. I've got a few thousand followers on Twitter, all Newcastle fans. I have not heard one positive thing about Steve Bruce. This is a good appointment. And Steve Bruce being from Wall's End, it means nothing. I mean, get Sting in. Sting's from Wall's End. Gordon Sumner, he can do a job. It means nothing. Steve Bruce hasn't lived in the region since he was a teenager. So there's no point in it. It doesn't count for anything. It's this modern day football. You don't need to be from the region to achieve success. And he hasn't achieved success at his last two clubs. So I don't know how he's been given this chance to take a Premier League club and try and turn things around. It's just not going to happen. And unfortunately, it counts for nothing on the pitch and off the pitch with the fans.
OK, well, going back to the big win yesterday, a couple of moments stand out. Obviously, two people being caught on camera saying things that they perhaps shouldn't have said. We'll stick with Bruce to begin with. Now, it appears, this is by no way confirmed, but it appears that he was reacting to the fans singing "We want Ashley out." And then Steve Agnew made a note to say to him, Steve, you're on camera, mate. You're on camera. Just don't say anything like that. And he sort of puts his head into his chest. But it looked like he said, we want Ashley out. What's that going to be like at home? We're only in China.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he must be aware of the, you know, the fire pit that he's coming into. But he himself could never turn this job down. He did support the club as a boy, and you know he's probably on more money than he was on at Chef Wed. And it's a chance for him to manage in the Premier League. It'll be his last big job. He'd be absolutely mad to turn the job down, and not many people really would have took the job. Steve Bruce is one of them. He was, you know, that was the aisle that we were shopping in. We Mike Ashley sent our managing director Lee Charney to Europe to try and find a replacement for Rafa Benitez, and he's come back with Steve Bruce. So he's tried
Vieira's,
Van Bronckhorst, you know, Roberto Martinez, Gerrard, Sam Allardyce, all said no, and we're in the Steve Bruce aisle now, and lo and behold, he is our manager.
Okay, well, Jonjo Shelvey, now he's made some interesting comments as well. You know, he said that he thinks this could be a good thing, that he needed a change, and he thinks that, well, he knows that he prefers a manager who talks to the players. And you get the sense that obviously him and Rafa didn't quite get on. He's adopting a new role, it seems to be just in front of that defence, just like shepherding the midfield, as it were. But there was an interesting moment yesterday, obviously, when Sean Longstaff tapped in his effort, which looked like it was going wide, to be fair, but Shelvey didn't seem too happy about it.
Well, he's a sensitive soul, isn't he, Jonjo? And I think what his comments about Rafa not saying a lot to the players, it kind of checks out with what other big players have said about Rafa. Steven Gerrard was famously said, you know, he never really properly had a conversation with Rafa in the entire time that he was in charge of him at Liverpool. And Shelvey, I think Shelvey had a funny season last season. He had this weird thigh injury that he couldn't shake, and he was back and forth from Barcelona trying to get fit. And then when he was fit, Rafa didn't really trust him and ended up going with Longstaff and Hayden for the second half of the season, which was when we really hit form and got ourselves out of the relegation battle. And I think Rafa, you know, gave him his chance. He didn't take it and, you know, didn't speak to him. And Shelvey didn't have a very good season. And he was doing a lot of weird things, like he was saying, oh, I've got a sports psychologist, I'm keeping a diary. And it was just a bit of a strange season for him. And on the whole, I think he's probably glad that there's a bit of a fresh start there. And actually, looking at the highlights of the game yesterday, he seemed to have a really good game, and he looked fit, and he was back to the old Jonjo, you know, picking the ball up off the centre-halves and spraying unbelievable diags. So maybe, you know, it's going to be a good thing for some players.
Okay, Matt. Now, look, before you go, where are we and where are Newcastle fans right now? Because Steve Bruce is the manager. He's going to start the season as manager of Newcastle. You're going to want to get behind your club. Are people going to vote with their feet and just not turn up at home games and away games? Or are people going to just turn up and hope for the best?
I think it's going to be very interesting, because sometimes I think our fan base is a bit too loyal for its own good. And we've had a few abortive attempts at boycotts, but I think there's a real momentum behind a boycott this season. Looking at some stats that have been leaked out of the club, I think this time last year we had about 38,000 season ticket holders. From what I hear, that number's now at about 26,000. And our season ticket system is a bit complicated in that a lot of fans, you know, up to 20,000 fans, are locked into these 10-year price freezers. So maybe about 5 years ago, and myself included, I'm on one of these deals myself for my season ticket, the club offered the 10-year price freeze. So if you're locked into that, if you were to cancel your season ticket and then renew it, say if we got a takeover, if you were to renew it, you'd end up paying about 30, 40% more for your season ticket. So about 20,000 fans are locked into that. And from what I believe, there's about 26,000 people who have renewed their season tickets. So there has been, you know, 12,000 people reportedly, from what I understand, have cancelled. So I'm intrigued as to see what the attendance is going to be for our first game. It's a big game. It's on TV. If I was to guess, I still think our fans are too loyal for their own good. I still think it would be a healthy crowd in the 40,000s. But long term, I think you're going to see a lot less fans at games. And the shirts have gone down like a lead balloon. Nobody's buying the shirts. I'm speaking to people. I don't live in the region anymore, but I'm speaking to people back home. Nobody's seen anyone walking around in the new shirt. It's not the best designed shirt. It's the most expensive shirt in the Premier League, by the way. If you want to buy the player replica, it's £90. So thanks for that, Mike. And I just think there's something a bit different about this. There's a lot of fed up fans up there, because we don't support a club anymore. It's Mike Ashley FC. It's like supporting a billboard. There's nothing to support there. So why should fans renew their season tickets, which have been put up in price, by the way. If you're not on the price freeze, the season tickets went up by about 10 to 20%. So he's sacked Rafa Benitez, or not renewed Rafa Benitez's contract, put the season tickets up, and come out with a £90 replica shirt. So it's classic Mike Ashley, and I think the fans have definitely had enough.
Wow. Okay, mate. On that note, I mean, happy times at St James's Park next season, then.
Exactly, mate. Let's just watch the car crash unfold, and I don't think it's going to be a great one. But, you know, I would love nothing more than for Steve Roos to come in and get wins, but I can't see it happening, to be honest.
Awesome. Matt, thanks for your time, buddy.
No problem. Cheers, mate.
That was Matt Ketchell, football writer for Match of the Day magazine, quite clearly unhappy with the situation at Newcastle, as everybody else seems to be. Now, we are going to talk about some netball coming up. Just want to touch on Mr. Zlatan Ibrahimovic, because this week he played in El Trafico, the splendidly named derby between Los Angeles FC and LA Galaxy. Now, in the build-up to the game, a lot of people were talking about Carlos Vela, and he was asked about Carlos Vela and the fact that Carlos Vela was the leading scorer in the MLS, and he made a point of the fact that if Carlos Vela's in his prime, he's 29, Zlatan was playing in MLS and he's in his prime. When he was 29, he was in Europe, and it was a big difference. The game came up, obviously, Vela scored twice. What did Zlatan do? He scored a hat-trick. Not only that, he scored a perfect hat-trick. Right foot, left foot, and a header. After the game, he warned people not to compare him to Carlos Vela. He told the media they'd made a massive error, and then he simply tweeted, "I am LA." He is Zlatan. Coming after this, we're talking about netball.
Giving your team a voice. Love Sport Radio.
Now, you talk about lifting the level and getting players like yourself, and you said right now you're the best player in Major League Soccer. There's another player in Los Angeles, Carlos Vela. In this moment, he's got 19 goals, 12 assists, and his team is leading Major League Soccer. Do you still consider yourself the best player in Major League Soccer?
By far. Because if he's in his prime, how old is he?
Carlos Vela's
29. 29. He's playing in MLS and he's in his prime. Mm-hmm. When I was 29, where was I?
Yeah, you were in Europe.
Big difference.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely brilliant, that from Zlatan. By the way, he said that far better than I attempted to say it before we went to the ads. And that is what you get from Zlatan. It's worth noting as well that his first game was against Los Angeles FC when he bagged a brace after coming off the bench, scored one from the halfway line, which we should also mention, as did Harry Kane today, a wonderful goal in the International Champions Cup against Juventus. In the dying moments, a goal from the halfway line over his old rival, Wojciech Szczesny, who obviously used to play for Arsenal. I imagine there'll be plenty of chat in North London about that goal, but plenty of chat now about the Netball World Cup. Of course, England just missing out on a final appearance in the Women's Netball World Cup, held in Liverpool, another World Cup on home soil. Obviously, we've just recently seen the Cricket World Cup in England, which we were successful in. This one just missed out, but did get third place after beating South Africa today. I'm delighted to say that we have got ex-England international Lindsay Keeble on the line. She won 12 caps for England, and I'm sure she's got plenty to say on today's third place. How are you doing, Lindsay?
Hi, I'm doing really well. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, what are your thoughts on this? Because there was such sadness at the defeat to New Zealand, but they've gone out on a high today, haven't they?
Yes, definitely. They came away with a medal, which is fantastic, because obviously you always have that fourth place worry when you're in those sort of playoffs. So it's great to see that they actually got their performance into gear and came out with a bronze today. I think, obviously, the fact that New Zealand won today is kind of like a bittersweet taste losing to them. At least they lost to the eventual winners. But I do think they showed real grit and determination throughout the whole World Cup to actually show the potential that they could have made it to the final and actually were whispers away from making it another gold medal. Took the cap there, Commonwealth gold last year.
Now, I have to admit, I've always been a fan of netball, but I imagine like a lot of the population in England is very much an armchair fan. And like we see with so many World Cup tournaments, you just tend to watch the big major events, and this is one of them. And I have to say, Helen Housby massively impressed me. She does not miss, does she?
No, she's phenomenal. She is the last minute queen as well. I think she's sunk some of the most videoed, most watched last goal to win a gold medal at the Commonwealth Games, to win Super League titles, to win other England matches. She is the shooting queen, and she works alongside Joe Harton as well, who's also a phenomenal shooter. I think they're known as H2 at this World Cup this year, so they really have shown they're actually a formidable duo, and they've absolutely performed and smashed it today when they came out and won by 12 goals against South Africa.
The conversation, Lindsay, when we have tournaments like this, it's very much the case when we had the Olympics in 2012, and you see all the, for want of a better term, lesser sports getting the airtime that they probably deserve more of. Obviously, we're used to football and rugby and cricket and boxing and all these other sports gaining airtime. When we have these lesser known sports, everybody turns around and goes, crikey, I want to take it up. That's brilliant. They're so good. They should get more money. They should get more airtime. What do we need to now do to capitalise on this World Cup being in England?
I think the hype and the fact that so many people have stopped me in the street, spoken to me. I was lucky enough to go up to Liverpool myself, and I was in casual clothing. People were stopping me for photos. It's unreal that people just on this bandwagon about netball. And I just think it's such an empowering sport where women are the dominant sex that play it. So we're not in a male shadow. We're not in a male competitiveness. There are male teams that play. There are many males that play sport, but females are leading the way, and the females are the ones that are dictating where this sport goes. And I think that's something that hopefully will be the legacy that leaves from the Liverpool World Cup, because I think it's just phenomenal to get so many women into sport. And it's been great to hear conversations where mums have gone, oh, I've had a kid and I'm really excited, I really want to get back into netball, or oh, I used to play netball at school or university and I like missed out when I moved to a new place. And it's like, no, go and find a team. It's so social, it's a great sport, it's competitive, you can find fun leagues. Like, there's just so many dimensions to netball that people are unaware of. We even have walking netball, so for all those parents and grandmas and granddads who can't function in a proper netball court, they can play even walking netball. And I just hope that this momentum that we've created from such an exciting tournament, that we can really keep it going and just encourage people to just take up any sport, even if they try netball and they choose another one. It's just exciting to be in a place where sport is the forefront of so many people's minds right now. I just hope that the bug of any sport will keep people going and get people off the sofa and at their local gym, at their local sports hall, or on a field, on a court, wherever it is, to get themselves out and just have a go at it.
Walking netball, who knew that was a thing?
Yeah, there is walking netball, and we've just we kept the way for football. There's even walking football now as well, so we're kind of pioneers when it comes to trying to get people back into our sport. So we are trying to keep it as open to every single person. We've got some amazing groups and amazing teams that help support girls with disabilities. We've got Down syndrome teams, we've got competitions, we've got everything. So we really are an inclusive sport who really want as many people to take up the most amazing game that I've ever played.
It's interesting you mentioned the fact that people come to you and they say, I used to play netball at school. It's a common problem, isn't it, with so many sports. I mean, I used to play tennis as a kid and I used to do athletics a lot, but when I finished school, because I guess clubs aren't, or you're not aware perhaps that clubs are readily available, I just stuck purely to football and that was that. And I kind of think, do you know what, I wish I'd applied myself to maybe the other sports where there's perhaps a better chance of having a future in them.
Yeah, I think it's a real shame about sport. You kind of get to 16 and it's kind of your cut-out point. Like, a lot of people choose to go down the academic route and they want to focus on their studies, or like you say, they move away from university or get a job and they just can't fit it in. So it's a real shame that people do lose touch with the sport that they grew up with as a young person, that they really loved and enjoyed. I just think it's something that I think the art of volunteering is slowly dying out. So the opportunities aren't always there. So sometimes people aren't brave enough to make the leap themselves, to put themselves out there and to organise their mate to a kickabout, or get people down to the local courts and have a hit, or get a group of girls together, boys together, to play some basketball, netball. So I think it's something that we as a nation need to really step up and take on board, the fact that we need to try a bit harder and actually engage the local community and local people and get out there and do your research, find people who are passionate about sports and want to share their knowledge. And, you know, I've got a cousin who coaches hockey to ladies who want to get back into hockey. Myself, I go out to local communities and work really hard with my old clubs, new clubs, anyone who wants to get a little bit better at netball. And, you know, I work in a school myself, so I try really hard to get girls at a really young age to just enjoy being in a team, enjoy the perks that a team brings, not just that on the court but off the court as well. That group of things, learning new things about yourself. And yeah, I just think sport's an amazing way to open up so many different parts of your life and just get so many amazing experiences from it.
Wonderful. And Lindsay, just before you go, Tracy Neville obviously on her way out. Is that going to be a shame now because of this momentum that we've built?
Oh, definitely. Like, Tracy's done a fantastic job. She has brought so much to netball. She's passionate. She's obviously got the most amazing heritage. Her brothers, who are doing a great job as well with female sport. It'll be a real shame to lose her, but I'm sure she will not be missing for too long. I'm sure she'll appear either in our age groups or come back as a coach, or maybe in our local super league. She might make an appearance as a coach. But I wish her well, and I just think whoever has got to step into those massive boots she's left behind has got a very difficult job ahead of them.
Great. Lindsay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.
That was Lindsay Keeble, ex-England international, commenting on the fact that the England women's netball team managed a third place in the World Cup today. Right, I think that is it. That is the Love Sport review.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.